With names like Spectre and Meltdown, the latest threats to cybersecurity sound a bit, oh, nightmarish. So how big a deal is this whole Intel chip thing anyway? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From WYPR in Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, January 4th. Thanks for being with us. Tech companies are racing to fix security flaws that could affect basically all of our computing. Researchers discovered the bugs months ago, but disclosed them yesterday. Known as Meltdown and Spectre, the flaws in computer processors could be used to steal sensitive data like bank records and passwords. Longtime cybersecurity journalist Kim Zetter joins me for some perspective on all this. Hello, Kim.
Hi.
So these names, Spectre and Meltdown, yes, they sound pretty scary. What are they exactly?
So Meltdown and Spectre refer to three different flaws that are affecting various chips. One flaw is referred to as Meltdown, and then the other two flaws together are being called Spectre. All three of these flaws affect a specific sort of function in these chips that is designed to make the processing more efficient or faster. And it's called speculative execution. And what the flaw does is that speculative process that the processor has launched remains in memory. And the flaws would allow malware on a system to access what's in that memory. And that could include passwords to the system. It could include chat logs. It could include photos, other sensitive data.
And you mentioned it's not just Intel chips, but Intel processors are in, 90% of the world's computer servers? That kind of monopoly seems a bit risky.
Yes. So the Meltdown affects only Intel, but the Spectre, the two other flaws affect Intel and AMD and ARM to certain degrees. So it's really a design flaw in the architecture and the way that these chips were built. So in that case, it wouldn't matter which chip you're using, right? There's going to be a problem.
So the chip makers have known about this for a while, right? It's just coming to light now. What are they doing about it?
So they're working on trying to figure out, the re-architecting. We have temporary fixes. The fixes that we're getting now, patches that are being released, are coming from operating system makers. So Apple has released a patch, Linux, Microsoft for Windows. And what they're doing is they are patching their software to further separate that cached memory from the applications that run on the system so that an attacker wouldn't be able to reach into that protected kernel, that protected cache memory. But that's a temporary fix. It's just not the core fix that's needed. So what's really needed here is that the chip makers redesign their chips. But that, of course, won't come with existing products. What you're going to see is forward-looking new products ultimately would come with the more protected chips.
So what should businesses and individuals do now if they're facing the theft of potentially very sensitive information or patches that could really slow down their work?
They should be applying the patches. That's the most that end users can do at this point. In terms of cloud services, Amazon, Google, other cloud providers are patching at their ends, but really it requires the user also to be patching their operating system. You know, the most that you can do is apply those patches. It really is now up to the architects of the chips to redesign them more securely to use it.
So, Kim, some people are describing this as catastrophic. I mean, do you see it as that apocalyptic?
It's catastrophic in the sense of how widespread it is. I mean, if you're talking about the core computing architecture, computing hardware, it's catastrophic in that sense because it is affecting all of these chips, as you point out, 90% of the servers, at least the Intel chips. It's not catastrophic in the sense that there isn't a way to address this or at least to mitigate the risk.
Kim Zetter is a cybersecurity journalist and author of Countdown to Zero Day. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
The Trump administration is cutting off most of the security aid it sends to Pakistan, the State Department said today. Relations have soured over the administration's concerns Pakistan is not doing enough to fight terrorism. The State Department did not say how much aid would be restricted, but previously had delayed more than $255 million in funds meant to help Pakistan's counterterrorism efforts. The U.S. auto industry had enjoyed a record 7-year run of growth in new car sales. But in 2017, the party seemed to end. The key word, though, is seemed. Yes, sales for the year fell by nearly 2%. But in a number of ways, the auto industry is still plenty healthy. From Washington, here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
Call it leveling off instead of a decline. 17.2 million new vehicles moved in 2017. That's just shy of an all-time high of 17.5. It follows a 7-year sales boom of a growing economy, millennial buyers boosting their credit, and pent-up demand coming to showrooms. But eventually, there was nothing pent up anymore, says Jessica Caldwell at Edmunds.
We kind of got to a saturation point. I mean, if you look at the number of cars per registered driver in the United States, it's at an all-time high. So we have more cars than drivers at this point, you know, and I think that's one of the reasons why things are starting to slow down a bit.
Also, lots of used cars came off leases to compete against new vehicles, and rental car companies bought less. Sales softened by mid-2017, so brands upped their incentives to keep the rally going. Jeffrey Byers is sales consultant at Westside Lexus in Houston. He says headquarters sent word to sell hard.
They were more aggressive. Even our golden opportunity that happens in August, they pushed it out even before August to be able to draw in people in the front door. That's never happened before that aggressively.
Before you shed a tear for the automakers, they sold an awful lot of pricey trucks and SUVs and crossovers. The average sale price last year rose to more than $35,000. Jeff Schuster is forecaster with LMC Automotive.
Selling larger priced vehicles, or higher priced vehicles, I should say, has led to improved margins and profitability for the automakers. So the automakers overall had a very good year.
He expects more softening in 2018 as interest rates creep up, but still a good car sale year, or I should say a good vehicle year. Passenger cars, as opposed to trucks and SUVs, make up a mere 1/3 of total sales. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, yes, the Dow broke 25,000, but as Kai would want me to remind you, the Dow is not the economy, and the economy is not the Dow. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Today, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions rescinded an Obama-era policy, one that helped legal marijuana thrive in parts of the United States. Sessions has been a longtime critic of marijuana legalization, blaming it for spikes in violence and comparing pot to heroin. What he repealed today is known as the Cole Memo. It discouraged federal prosecutors from bringing marijuana-related charges in states where the drug is legal. Marketplace's Rima Crace looks into what the change could mean for what's become a multi-billion-dollar industry.
The Cole Memo was the Obama administration's way of taking a hands-off approach to states that decided to legalize marijuana. And now that it's overturned,
there's not a directive to definitely go after marijuana businesses, but the door has been opened.
Jonathan Blanks is a research associate at the Cato Institute. He says now it'll be up to federal prosecutors on whether they want to crack down on marijuana dispensaries.
If they are a drug warrior like Jeff Sessions, all they need is a cease and desist memo from the Department of Justice, which would include shutting down the business and jailing the people who run the business.
But could they go after mom and pop shops?
No, they're not going to go after that.
Paul Larkin is a legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation and supports Sessions' move. He says federal prosecutors have limited resources.
What they'll do is they'll go after the people who are engaged in the unlawful interstate trafficking in marijuana.
8 states plus D.C. have now legalized recreational marijuana. It's a $6 billion plus industry with thousands of medical and recreational shops across the country. Sessions' move could make banks and financial institutions more wary of providing services for marijuana businesses, says Robert Mikos. He's a professor at Vanderbilt University Law School.
If banks all of a sudden are even more skittish, even more worried about the potential legal ramifications under federal law, then those services might dry up and it'll make business more difficult.
Mikos says today's decision could have a chilling effect on other parts of the industry, but he adds that administrations in the past have tried to impose crackdowns and that didn't stop the marijuana industry from growing. I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace. We'll be right back.
Private employers added a stronger-than-expected 250,000 jobs last month, according to payroll processor ADP and Moody's Analytics. We'll get fresh jobs numbers from the government tomorrow, but the latest unemployment rate is 4.1%, which means there aren't as many workers left sitting on the sidelines these days. In industries like construction, manufacturing, and hospitality, a lot of employers say they can't find enough skilled workers to fill their shifts. And some of them are having to say no to new business. So what's that like? From our bureau in Portland, Oregon, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
The tables are mostly full on a weekday morning at Cup and Saucer Cafe, an eggs and burgers type place where the waiters hand orders through a window in the dining room to short order cooks at a steaming grill. Amy Drake manages this location, one of three of the restaurants in town. She's pretty much always hiring. She says finding wait staff isn't so hard, but
cooks, a whole different story. It is a very specialized skill. The owner often steps in to fill in that position.
So sometimes the owner isn't managing, she's cooking. And Drake says when they're short-staffed, customers wait longer, plus
lately, having three cup and saucers, one or the other of them has not been able to open.
Which is money left on the table. That's also what's going on in housing, says Robert Dietz, chief economist at the National Association of Home Builders. There's plenty of demand, but not enough skilled workers to keep up.
It is absolutely reducing the number of homes we remodel and the number of homes that we can build in a given year.
More than 2 million construction workers lost their jobs in the recession. Many changed careers, went on disability, or retired. And there are now 750,000 fewer workers available than a decade ago. What's a contractor to do?
In some cases, they're putting off projects that should otherwise go ahead because the demand is there. In some cases, they're offering higher wages.
But some businesses just hit a wall when they can't find workers with the skills, clean record, and attitude needed for the job. That's the point registered nurse Judith Klinko has gotten to with her elder care company, Catalina In-Home Services, in Tucson, Arizona. She has 85 employees and says she does a dozen interviews to find one candidate she can hire.
We're turning down business. In home care, you either have a body who can go or you have nobody. And that means we have a frail elder who needs help with bathing, dressing, meal preparation, who's not going to have anybody in their home today.
Ultimately, businesses simply turning away business isn't sustainable economy-wide. One solution is more automation. Now, that won't work in every industry. It's hard to automate bathing and dressing someone in their home, for instance. But Robert Dietz says even in a job as hands-on as construction, change is coming.
Bringing in robots and other kinds of equipment at scale in high-density projects to allow workers to be more productive.
And as it gets harder to find workers, not all businesses are having to limit their growth. Julia Klein is CEO of C.H. Briggs, a building supply company with 200 employees in Reading, Pennsylvania. She says in the past year, she's raised salaries about 2.5%, even more for positions in short supply, like commercial truck drivers.
We know that we need to come out of the gate with our very best offer because good candidates will leave, you know, before we even get them in the door for even a small increase in hourly pay.
Klein's focusing her management team on retaining talent. She says so far she hasn't had to turn business away, but her people are working harder, multitasking, and doing
some scrambling,
which is what the U.S. economy as a whole could do as labor markets get tighter and companies have to meet demand and keep their customers satisfied. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You know, do you want a public utility to handle this payment service?
The future of Fedcoin, or not. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 152 points, 0.6%, breaking 25,000 for the first time. It closed at 25,075. The NASDAQ lifted 12 points, 0.1%, to finish at 70.77. And the S&P 500 went up 10 points, 0.4%, to end at 27.23. As we told you up top, auto sales fell for 2017, but December numbers still beat expectations. Ford shares accelerated 1.7%. GM drove up 3%. Tesla slowed down 0.8%. The Interior Department wants to open more U.S. waters for offshore gas and oil drilling, putting over 90% of available acreage up for lease. Drilling firm Baker Hughes rose 3.2%. Exxon was up 0.1%. Chevron dipped 0.3%. Retail holiday sales numbers are coming in weaker than investors hoped. Macy's dropped 3.3%. JCPenney lost 0.2%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. This week, China introduced new restrictions on the import of foreign waste, and that could be a problem for countries like Britain, Germany, and the U.S. For years, we've been sending much of our plastic waste to China for recycling. Now China is trying to fight its own pollution and no longer wants to be the world's dumping ground. The BBC's Robin Brandt has this report from Shanghai.
China has been recycling for decades. In this grimy, smelly yard by a flyover in Shanghai, the workers sort on the ground floor and they live in tiny apartments on the floor above.
Okay, let's have a look at this array of bags. And this one on the left, this is the biggest. That's circuit boards, plastic power packs. This one, kind of phone packs, phone coverings. And this one at the end, mice, computer mice.
This man has made a living out of bashing, breaking up, and disassembling. He's been doing it for 5 years. It's hard work, he told me. Tiring. But they are not green warriors. They live and work in this concrete yard because there's money in it. China needs the raw materials, so much so that Chinese workers have been sorting through your waste, shipped in from abroad. It imported 7.3 million tons of plastic alone in 2016, but most of that is about to end. These children are crouching on a riverbank, picking up dead fish amid plastic bottles and bags. China has become a much richer but much dirtier country. It's blighted by homemade pollution and contamination on a vast scale. The government claims some foreign waste is dangerous, and the last thing this country needs is even more of that. Wang Wang is from the China Scrap Plastics Association.
China's ban is putting the onus back on all the waste exporting countries. You need to shoulder the responsibility of disposing your own waste and your own sources of pollution.
The ban presents a problem for China, though. It needs the paper, the cardboard, the clean, high-quality polystyrene that's simple to ship to this country and simple to turn into something you can then sell. This is an industrial chipper. It disintegrates polystyrene, tons of it. And somewhere in this load there are fish boxes from Grimsby on England's east coast. The business on the outskirts of Shanghai ships them, chips them, heats them, and then turns them into something to sell back to you.
In a nutshell, it's pretty simple what they do here. They take this, a bit of polystyrene. It's compressed and sent here to China, and then they turn it into this. These are little green pellets of plastic about the size of half a peanut. And then eventually, it's moulded into this, photo frames.
This is core components, all German.
And it cuts it, and yes, then it comes out.
Yes, coming out.
But China's ban means the boss is going to have to send his UK waste elsewhere. The ban on foreign waste will hurt some business here, but the government's view is tough. Delivering a cleaner China is paramount for the Communist Party politicians. A green revolution, you might call it.
The BBC's Robin Brandt in Shanghai. The Securities and Exchange Commission is warning investors to exercise caution with virtual currencies like Bitcoin. In a statement today, the SEC warned that regulators may not be able to recover money lost in fraudulent deals. Bitcoin is just one of hundreds of so-called cryptocurrencies. They've been developed by anonymous programmers and private businesses and have all sorts of potential uses, but lack many of the protections of traditional cash. Lately, there have been calls for governments to develop their own digital currencies. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has more on what that would look like.
You may know digital currencies from being confused about what they do and what they're used for, you and a lot of people. But central banks across the world are thinking about creating their own. Why would a central bank want its own digital currency? Well, because money today is not very efficient.
If you use paper cash, it's expensive.
Andrew Levin teaches economics at Dartmouth.
Consumers have to pay usually something like a 3% fee at the ATM to take out paper cash.
Credit cards and debit cards seem easy when you swipe, but actually, they're pretty clunky on the back end.
Payments take hours or days to settle.
And that coffee shop that takes credit cards is paying the credit card company fees.
That's absurd. That should probably not be what the future of money looks like.
Sahil Gupta is CEO of Microchange. So cash has problems, credit cards and debit cards have problems, and Gupta says even existing cryptocurrencies have problems. Bitcoin, for example, has high transaction fees.
For your ordinary person, it's just like not really useful right now because it swings in value. Not a lot of merchants accept it.
So how would a Federal Reserve-run digital currency make all of these problems better? Well, people wouldn't notice a difference on the surface. They'd keep using cards or their phone or apps to spend money. But under the hood of the financial system, things would be very different. It starts with the technology behind digital currencies. The computer code the money is made of is called a blockchain.
The blockchain you can think of essentially in the abstract as a kind of bulletin board.
Ari Jules co-directs the Initiative for Cryptocurrencies and Contracts at Cornell Tech. He says the blockchain is a kind of encrypted, verifiable bulletin board.
All of the transactions in the system can be recorded on the blockchain.
Long story short, what this means is that you don't need to pay someone or some bank to process payments. There's no lag time of hours or days. There's no chance of getting something wrong. The technology just automatically makes transactions happen smoothly. And the system would be controlled by the government.
Essentially, what you would have is one giant ledger. And in this ledger, the government would have the ability to issue coins.
The coins would be equivalent to dollars. They wouldn't swing in value like Bitcoin because the government would guarantee their value, just like it does for paper currency.
The advantages are that it's possible in principle to trace essentially all monetary flows in the system.
Jules says the Fed could better assess risks in the economy this way. Other analysts suggest the government could also tax transactions in the economy more easily. But one of the biggest benefits for the Fed would be the ability to control the money supply more directly. Again, Dartmouth's Andrew Levin.
This is an important monetary policy tool, as well as improving the efficiency of the payment system.
For example, the Fed could offer interest on all digital cash. It could charge interest if it needed to. This would give it unprecedented control over the economy. But if the national payment system was done with digital currency on a government-controlled system, there would be a big potential loser. Banks.
And the question is, you know, do you want a public utility to handle this payment service, or do you want to delegate the responsibility to the private sector?
David Andelfato is a vice president in the research division of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. His opinions are his own.
In the United States, the choice was made to delegate the responsibility to the private sector.
Fed Vice Chair Randall Quarles addressed digital currencies in a speech in November. He said he was concerned about the disruption that might occur if payment activity suddenly shifted out of the private sector banking system into a Fed-run digital currency system. Fed Governor Jerome Powell, the next Fed chairman, said last March users might have serious privacy concerns if digital currency was trackable by the government. Overall, Fed officials have been cautious. But federally run digital currency is one vision of the future they are certainly thinking about. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
This final note, From the sometimes non-presidential tweets can be newsworthy department, Spotify, the world's largest music streaming service, tweeted today that it has 70 million subscribers. That would put its membership at more than twice the size of its rival Apple Music. And how much are 70 million subscribers worth? That's a question potential investors will be pondering. Spotify filed confidentially yesterday for an initial public offering. All right, we got to go. Today, the Dow rose 152 points, 0.6%. The Nasdaq lifted 12 points, or 0.1%, and the S&P 500 climbed 10 points, or 0.4%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Tro are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Amy Scott. We'll be back again tomorrow. This is APM.